Our speaker,
as you know from your program, is Brother Eugene Burns from New Brunswick. And he's chosen as his subject, I Will Show You the Judgment. I Will Show You the Judgment. As you can see, it will be illustrated. Brother Eugene.
First of all, brethren, I want to say I'm happy to be here. I bring the love and greetings of the New Brunswick Ecclesia and also of my good wife, Ruth. Our subject today, these are the subject announced, of course, are the words of the angel. And as a subject that we're all interested in, the judgment of that woman. And we know that the souls from under the altar in the ashes there cried out, how long, O Lord, until thou wilt judge her and avenge our blood upon her. And so all who love the Lord, even up until the time of her destruction, when she goes down in Revelation 18, when that great city is destroyed, some are saying, alas, alas, that great city, what city was like unto her. But others are saying, rejoice, O ye heavens over her, and ye apostles, for the Lord has avenged you upon her. And so we are in this class, a class that are interested in the judgment of this woman. Now, before we go further into Revelation 17, we feel it imperative to get the contrast. There are five beasts in Revelation, three of which have many similarities and yet are quite diverse. And somehow or other, much of the difficulty in understanding these three beasts occurs when they began to confuse the beast and talk about qualities of one that pertain to another, and pretty soon the whole thing begins to get out of focus. And so we have attempted to give you a little assistance here with some slides. The artist is Brother Harry Nugent, who worked with us very closely in developing these, and I hope they will be a help to us. The first beast, well, first of all, I want to say there are three beasts that have similarities. There are five that we will mention briefly, but we're only going through these like in a thumbnail sketch, so you get the contrast, so you won't confuse the beasts with one another. There are three beasts that have seven heads and ten horns. This is one of them, the dragon, in Revelation 12. Now, the dragon, the vision of the dragon in Revelation 12 starts off in heaven, but it doesn't stay there. The dragon, of course, represents civil Rome. I know that many times brethren will say it represents pagan Rome because of an early reprint article, but that's often the case because there's an article directly on the 12th chapter. Brethren failed to collect everything that Brother Russell says, but if you look in the fourth volume, you'll find that he identifies it correctly there as civil Rome. And we say more correctly because this dragon is a long-lived creature. You know, you can tell the ages of horses by looking at their teeth. But you can tell the age of these dragons by counting heads. This one has seven heads. That represents successions of government in the Roman Empire. This dragon is a long-lived creature. I hasten to remind you that he's still alive. He will continue alive and functioning until he's destroyed. The seventh plague is poured out. You see there's a triumvirate out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. So they're on the scene up until the very end. So don't think that this applies way back when. This creature is a long-lived creature. Now, if you will notice, there are seven crowns. And where are they? They're on the heads, where they ought to be, where you would normally expect them to be. But that means there are only seven. Now, this dragon was quite violent when it came to a seat in heaven and the religious authority. Apparently, the dragon wanted to rule the heavens. He wanted a civil ruler who would both rule heaven, the ecclesiastical heavens and earth. But it didn't eventuate that way. This dragon, which was originally in the vision, is seen in heaven. He finally is, as a result of a war in heaven, he's cast out of heaven and he comes to earth. And the proclamation is made, "Woe unto you that live on the earth, for the dragon has come down to you having great wrath." Now, the 12th chapter story is not complete. Many of the chapters in Revelation don't tell you the whole story. And the finishing of the 12th chapter, you find that the dragon is angry. And he's going to make war with the remnant of the woman's seed. But that's where it ends. The other chapters pick up and they tell you the rest of the story. So now this represents civil Rome or civil government, the properly authorized rulers of earth, that in a sense would be the ones that God recognized are the ones to rule on earth. And we see Rome then from its civil standpoint. Started at the time of Constantine, we believe that was the first head. And we believe the last head was the Nazi fascist regime. And it continues on beyond the seven heads into the time of its destruction. All right, now we've got to hurry on. We're not talking about Revelation 12, so forgive the hurried approach here. We want to really get on to the last beast, but we've got to get the contrast. All right, now Revelation 13, we are introduced to the leopard-like beast, a peculiar beast. If there ever was a peculiar beast, it has the body of a leopard, the mouth of a lion, the feet of the bear, and its overall appearance is dreadful. It's a composite beast of the four universal empires. This beast, where does it come from? It comes from the sea. Rises out of the restless masses who are disenchanted with society looking for something better. Now, this beast also has seven heads and ten horns. But if you are looking very closely and a close observer, how many crowns are there? They're not seven, there are ten. And these crowns are upon the horns. Now, all of these details mean something, and they represent something different. We can't get involved with an explanation of this at the point, but keep the distinctions in mind. The Revelator was enormously careful to give us distinctions after distinction after distinction. And then when we start, you know, letting the distinctions slip and begin to confuse them, why, it's kind of unpardonable because he goes to such lengths to make the distinctions for you. So keep the distinctions in mind. Now, this leopard-like beast is a long-lived beast, too. Same period of time as the other beast. It continues on up until out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the dragon. It's the leopard-like beast that is spoken about that's on the scene up until Armageddon. Don't be fooled with any concept that says that this beast is past. The scriptures clearly teach, without question, that that beast is alive and functioning up until the time of that great earthquake, so mighty and so great, in which the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the Great comes up in remembrance before God to drink of the cup of wrath. No, we're not at that point, but this beast is on the scene till then. But the important thing to notice, there was a relationship between this dragon and the leopard-like beast. The dragon, who was so violent and fighting about a seat in the religious world, turned out to be quite a gentleman when it came to giving this beast a seat in civil government. The dragon gave this beast his seat and great authority. So they're not, you know, oceans apart. They're a similarity. Satan controls both of them. But they're showing you, this shows you papal Rome. The dragon shows you civil Rome. And there's a lot in common, but there's a lot of distinction. All right, now we must go on. This beast, of course, is quite different. I don't know how you describe it. The Revelator says it had two horns. Represents the Church of England and Ireland. Rises out of the earth. Stable society. It has horns like a lamb. But it speaks like that dragon. Oh, it has powerful words. And how well it represents the Church of England and Ireland. The government of the British Empire involved with these church systems. It was just a little group of people, a small body of people, but how influential they were. Their horns weren't that great. They weren't that overpowering, but it was the mouth that enabled this beast to do great miracles. Why, this beast was able to perform miracles in the sight of the leopard-like beast. And believe me, that this beast caused that leopard-like beast's eyes really to pop out at times as it watched what it was doing. You know, this beast was able to do what the leopard-like beast was never able to do. This beast was able to take Jerusalem. And it had control of it for a time. Not for long, but it had control of it for a time. That's more than the papacy was enabled to do with all its holy crusades. They never were very successful. So it had power to perform miracles. But we're interested in this beast from another standpoint. This beast had power to suggest making of another beast, and additionally, that is, it suggests that the earth make, it suggests that they make an image to the leopard-like beast, and not only did it have power to suggest this, but later on, after the beast is formed, this beast has the power to give the image of the beast life. So that's what makes us interested in that. Now, the next is the image of the beast, and of course, it has to look like the leopard-like beast, and it does. It stands in the presence of the leopard-like beast. You'll see the leopard-like beast in the background. Now it's standing on the ground, on society. Once this beast is vitalized, it becomes a power very much like the leopard-like beast. It has the big mouth tendencies, the boasting words. It has the grasping feet of the bear, like the Medo-Persian Empire, which reached under the gate and took Babylon. It has the camouflage of the leopard, and its overall appearance is dreadful. These are all beasts, brethren, that we believe you and I have yet to reckon with. And that's why we think that we should consider it very carefully. I don't think we have felt the power of this beast, but we shall. Now, We've gone into the background. Now, here's the third beast that has seven heads. This beast, well, for the most part, is in the abyss until after the seventh head. Then it emerges, the beast itself, without a head, which we'll get into. Now, carefully note, there are seven heads and there are ten horns. How many crowns do you see? I hope you don't see any, because there are none. This is a poor beast. Poor in many ways. Poor because it has that cursed woman, that Jezebel, that awful woman sitting on it. But it's not sitting on the beast either itself. It's sitting on the waters. It's a funny thing, but Revelation describes it both ways. This woman is said to sit clearly on the waters, and it's also said to sit upon the seven heads. And so this implies a strong relationship, of course, but it shows, to show this, the artist put a watery throne, and then he placed it on the heads to show something that would not literally be possible. This is a beast that you would never see anywhere except in Revelation, in the vision of Jesus Christ, which he gave to us. Now, this beast, now I think we'll end the slides momentarily, and we'll try to get into Revelation 17. Oh, wait. Can we just turn this off now for a bit? And we can have the lights on. We're done with the visual part. We only wanted it for the contrast. One of the angels, returning to Revelation 17, one of the angels who had the seven vials, bowls, came and said to me, "Come, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot, who is seated upon many waters." Now, we believe the angel here, of course, is one of the seven. It goes back to Revelation 15, in which there are seven angels. And this is one of them, and we believe, of course, it represents the harvest message, and this particular angel, we think, represents the message that we have in the second volume on the man of sin. It is this chapter which has shown us this woman and its judgment. Now, this woman, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and with the wine of whose fornication the dwellers on earth have become drunk. All right, now that's the introduction. And then the John class, who represents the saints who are in the Spirit on the Lord's day. I think it's important that we recognize what day we're in. If we are not in the Lord's day, then none of these things apply. But if we are those who are convinced that we are in the millennial day, the Lord's day, then the understanding of this vision is applicable. And I think we are those who believe that we are in the spirit-begotten condition on the Lord's day. You know, the Lord said he was Lord of the Sabbath, and so we are in his Sabbath day. Now, to see this, he carried me, that is, John class, away in the Spirit into a wilderness, a separate condition from the world. And there I, that is, John, the John class, saw a woman sitting on a scarlet-colored beast, which was full of the names of blasphemy, and it had seven heads and ten horns. Now, the woman is said to sit upon this beast, and the beast is said to have names of blasphemy. We think that originally Rome, which started out as a republic, long before even the woman was on the scene, Rome was originally a republic, and it was ruled by a Senate, and there were two houses in the Senate, as it were. There were the patricians, who were the aristocracy, and the plebeians, which was the representation of the middle class. Now, this is not the time in which the woman is sitting on the beast. She's sitting on the heads when one of the heads emerged. At that time, it was a headless beast in the sense that there was no emperor ruling over a great empire, but the common people had a voice in the government. We'll get into that a little more. Now, this beast was a blasphemous beast. It embodied all the heathen gods were represented in this beast. All the falsities of the gods of this world were represented in it. And so many gods were there that they even built an image in Paul's day to the unknown god and make sure they didn't leave any out. And so it was a blasphemous beast. It carried all the false religious worship, blasphemy of the world with it. And later this woman rides it on its head. Now this woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet. I don't think there's any question here to this audience of what the woman represents. Of course, it represents that unfaithful church, the Roman Catholic Church. Was arrayed in purple and scarlet and royalty, and bedecked with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup, which was the Lord's word. But she didn't hold it as the Lord's word for the beauty that was contained in it, because in this cup was filled with her abominations and the impurities of her fornication. So it was the Lord's word on the outside, but on the inside it was full of sin and filthiness. It was only a front. Now on her forehead was written a name of a mystery: Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman. Oh, this woman, not only sitting, but she was drunk. She was completely inebriated with the blood of the saints and of the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Oh, the guilt of this woman is is unquestionable. Now, this woman, of course, is more than a church. She's a city. She's a government. Now here you've got a composite picture of a government and a woman together, showing that it embodies more than just a church, but it's a church involved in world government. It's a city, Babylon the Great. Now, of course, all of this was in the initial explanation and the initial vision, which didn't mean too much to the John class until the angel explained it. Now, John said, "When I saw her, I marveled greatly." And the angel said to me, "Why marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman." Oh, it's a mystery of iniquity. That's what it is. You know, there's the mystery of godliness. Of a truth, great is the mystery of godliness, of holiness. But there's also another mystery, the mystery of iniquity. And here the angel says, "I will tell you the mystery of the woman." And not only that, but he's going to give us a description of this beast. All right. Now, in the seventh verse, he says, "The beast with the seven heads and the ten horns that you saw was and is not and is to ascend from the bottomless pit and to go into perdition. The beast that was and is not, that is to come again, to come out of the abyss condition, and then goes into perdition. Now, this beast was at one time, before it went into the dormant condition, before it became suppressed. And we believe that represents Rome at the outset, when it was a republic, when the common people, when the people of Rome had a voice in the government of the Roman Empire. Rome, as it started out, as we said before, had the patricians and the plebeians. And as time went on, the same thing happened to it that happened almost like to England. The aristocracy became a minority, and so the house of the patricians, or the ruling house of the patricians, became less influential. And the plebeians, the Senate, the plebeian part of the Senate, began to have more and more to say. And if the Senate wouldn't give the people what they wanted, see, they were very much represented in government in Rome in its beginning. And when they couldn't get what they wanted from the Senate, why, then they would appeal to the generals. The popular masses and the generals would ingratiate the people. They would give them what they wanted. But, of course, that was dangerous. They didn't realize that once they began to do away with the power of the Senate, of the ruling classes proper, they would gradually have a ruler that would give them what they wanted, but they would also lose their voice in government gradually. Pretty soon the ruler would become great and overpowering. And that's what happened in Rome. Rome began to start it out as a grand republic, and it began to deteriorate. In the days of our Lord, it was still a republic, and at the time of Julius Caesar, why was he executed? Well, already the Senate was worried about the budding leaders that were overshadowing the democracy of Rome. And it was the Senate members that conspired against Julius Caesar because they were afraid he was going to become a king and an empire, set up an empire. And, of course, then the republic form of government, the government in which the people would have a representation, would gradually disappear, which it did. The very fears for which Julius Caesar was destroyed were the fears that were realized later. They were justified fears. Because later on we find the emperors beginning to arise on the seas. First the great generals, and then as they became more powerful, they began to have more to say, and gradually you find the republic began to fade. And from the republic emerged the great emperor, the emperors of Rome, in which the common people had nothing more to say in government, or very little to say, except that they would rise up in revolution. But they were no longer represented in the government. And we believe that all during the seven heads, the common people were in the abyss. Their form of government was in the abyss. Now, there's only one place that I know of where Brother Russell identifies this scarlet-colored beast, and that's on page 354 of The Time Is at Hand. Now, very often, this beast is identified, the scarlet-colored beast is so often confused with the papacy. And sometimes they'll refer to Brother Russell's writings as representing the papacy. But here, where Brother Russell is treating Revelation 17, he quotes it. On page 354, he says, as prior to the year 800, papacy was rising, supported by the Roman beast P, people and by its horns, powers. Now here he says the Roman beast was the people. And papacy, which was distinct, was rising, supported by this beast. So in other words, the Roman people, beast, is different from the papacy. The papacy is rising, being supported by this beast. In other words, it can't be the same thing. He's not saying the papacy was rising, being supported by the papacy. You see? If that's what he meant, why then it wouldn't make sense. But he's saying that the papacy, which is the leopard-like beast, was rising, being supported by the Roman beast, the scarlet-colored beast, which is very closely identified with the people. This beast is described, this woman is said to sit upon this beast, and she's said to sit upon the waters. A very close similarity. All right? Now, of course, in this chapter, the Man of Sin chapter, this particular quotation, Brother Russell is showing how the power of the papacy was broken in 1799, and it's easy. Many have just taken isolated paragraphs from the chapters and concluded that 1799 was the breaking of its power, and gradually it's just destroyed, and which of course is true. It is gradually destroyed. Daniel shows that it is broken and consumed until the end. But that was not Brother Russell's understanding of the matter. He felt that while it was its great power was being broken and it would be destroyed until the end, he clearly felt that there would be a great resurgence of power, and that we would expect a great deal of activity on the part of these systems. And he says in the same setting that even though her power is broken, she rules the world with more authority than many kings in their heyday. So the power being broken doesn't mean that it was powerless. It just didn't. It's the contrast of the breaking of the power. The day in which she ruled the world unquestionably. Now we're in a period in which her power is being broken gradually, but it doesn't prohibit or proscribe the idea that there would be a great resurgence of power, which, of course, we'll get into here. This chapter that we're studying shows that there is just that. And there are other chapters that show the same, as well as Brother Russell's writings. Now, he says, the beast that you saw was and is not, and is to ascend from the bottomless pit. When it was not, that's where it was. It was in the abyss, in a dormant condition. Doesn't mean it's dead. Satan will be in the abyss during the 1,000 years. That doesn't mean that he won't come out again. He will come out again, and he'll be quite vital and active when he ascends out of it. And so this beast here, which was dormant, was supporting the people, was supporting the woman all right, but the people, the people's form of government, they had no say in this government. All during these seven heads, there was very little representation of the people in the government. And it isn't until the eighth form of the beast without a head appears on the scene, and this, of course, Brother Russell felt, and John clearly counts the heads, there are only seven. And yet sometimes brethren will count eight. But the details show there are only seven. And that it's during the eighth form of the beast without a head, and it's possible to have a beast without a head, that the great judgment will take place that we're interested in. All right, now, he says this beast will ascend out of the pit and go into perdition, and the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to behold the beast. In other words, it'll be a great surprise that this form of government begins to exercise authority again, because it was and is not and is to come. In other words, at the beginning of the Lord's day, it was something that was yet to come. Now he goes on to say, this calls for a mind with wisdom. Then he describes it. The seven heads are seven hills or mountains on which the woman is seated. There are seven successions of government. In other words, each head holds power for a time. And then it goes off the scene and is succeeded by another head. In other words, each one of these heads isn't ruling at the same time, but there are a succession of heads. And it goes through the seven heads, or seven hills on which the woman is seated, and there are also seven kings. Now the "and" makes the kings distinct from the heads. Now we understand the seven heads. I'll give them briefly. The seven successions of government in the Roman Empire was the first started with Constantine. That's where the woman got its seat. Not that there wasn't a Roman government before that, but the vision is concerned with a woman and where she had a seat. Now that's the first place where the woman had a seat. Up until Constantine, the woman had no seat in the government. It was persecuted. Christianity was the unpopular religion. Just prior to that were the terrible days of persecution from Diocletian. Part of our text, "Be thou faithful unto death," applied at that time. It was a terrible period of persecution. But following this, the church, Christianity became recognized. And the religious leaders who were willing to go along with the state got a seat in the government very quickly. And we see that this is where the woman got her seat, and that's the period that's being covered in this vision. All of the visions that show the seven heads are identified, we believe, in the same period of time, from Constantine up until Armageddon. The second was of course, Constantine in his time was followed by Valentinian, who developed the Western Roman Empire. This was followed by Justinian, who developed the Eastern Roman Empire in 539, which we're very familiar with. And then there was the great empire of Charlemagne. Now, see, the difference between the head and the king is the king represents an emperor or a great ruler who sets in motion a government that continues maybe long after his lifetime. He sets up, for instance, Charlemagne set up a government that stayed in operation for 1,000 years. And so he was given the credit for being the king that set in operation this great empire which continued for so long. Then, of course, the next was the Napoleonic Empire. We believe the sixth was the Victor Emmanuel, and the seventh was the Nazi fascist. Now, I know on this, as soon as I mention the sixth, perhaps there would be many who would pick up their ears, and rightly so, because in reprint 2062, and an article which was a kind of a news and views article, Brother Russell there said in 1896 that the monarch and his father, Victor Emmanuel, are the seventh head. And perhaps it seems bold on my part to say that we believe it was the sixth. And Brother Russell felt, of course, there would be an eighth form of government without a head beyond that point. Well, again, we must, well, it is a distinction. This is the only area, perhaps, in which, a sensitive area, in which we would make an adjustment in Brother Russell's writing on prophecy. Nonetheless, we feel that to harmonize all that Brother Russell has written and to embody the over 80 years continuance of the kingdoms of this world on the scene and the successions of government that have followed, it seems justified, but I think the internal evidence is rather strong, too. The Revelator himself, I think, pinpoints the vantage point. In Revelation, he says that the seven kings, there are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is. All right, now let's take the vantage point. John Clask is standing separated in the wilderness condition. They're standing on the Lord's Day, beginning of the Lord's Day. One is. When would the vantage point be? It would be at the very beginning of the Lord's Day. Now, the Lord's Day, the millennial day, started in 1874. In 1871, the Vatican Palace, the Lateran Palace, and the papal villa at Castel Gandolfo were declared extraterritorial and belonging to the papal state. And so if we were to mark the beginning of the Lord's Day, he says one is, and another is yet to come. And so the one that was the Victor Emmanuel, which made it the sixth. And then following its collapse, there would be a seventh head. Now, the seventh head, we believe, emerged under the Nazi fascist regime in Germany. It was a head government. It ruled all of Europe. It was a government in which the common people had no voice. It was not a democratic form of government. There was a democratic form of government that it replaced. Germany had the Weimar Republic, quite a civilized government, as a matter of fact. But it fell under Hitler's barrage, and it went into a controlled state in which the papacy was still riding it. The woman was still riding this head. She was very much involved. If you you want to check closely on the Nazi fascist connections, it's just appalling. I have a book written on the Catholic Church in Nazi fascist Germany, and it's a documentary, and it's just appalling how much involved they were in the government, still sitting on the head, still sitting on a form of government she was. And now, after this collapse, the beast that was and is not is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes into perdition. Now, the seventh beast was to continue a little while, and certainly the Nazi fascist government continued a little while. Now he says the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdoms or no royal power as yet. But they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. Now he's talking about ten kings. Ten territorial rulers who have received no kingdoms as yet. But they apparently do get kingdoms. They do receive power, but only by special dispensation. You know how they get their kingdoms? From the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He gives them the dispensation for their kingdom. For one purpose: to judge and to fulfill the words of God against this woman. So we believe that following the Nazi fascist collapse, the people of Europe, for the first time, have emerged with a people's form of government. Now you have a democracy in Italy, in Germany, and spread throughout all of Europe. There are 10 nations now who are united. They haven't come to the point where they subscribe to a common form of government yet. But when this happens, I think here in Revelation 17 you have the most wonderful timepiece that was ever given. Prophetic timepiece. It's a chronometer to show you just when this woman is to be destroyed. And all of this history that we went past and through is only so that the person reading at the end could understand exactly where he is. And if we have read the matter correctly, we have gone past the period of the seven heads. We're in the period in which the form of the beast itself is emerging from Europe. Still supporting the woman. Oh yes, still very much supporting the woman. But not for long. All right, now, these ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdoms as yet. But these have one mind and give over their power and authority to the beast. In other words, there will never be another head of Europe. That was Brother Russell's thought. There would never be another central government controlling Europe. Of course, in his time, he thought that 1914 would see the kingdom. But since we have seen another head controlling Europe, in which the common people had no voice, and now we're living at a time in which there will never be another central authority over Europe. No one person, no one king is going to rule Europe again. That's clearly stated here. But they're going to have a coalition. These ten kings are going to agree, and they do get a kingdom, because when they get the kingdom, they give it unto the beast. They all agree and give their kingdom and their power and authority to the beast. And of course, their purpose in giving it to the beast is not really to fulfill the words of God. They don't think that at all. But, of course, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he's master of the situation, and he's allowing them to outwork his purpose. Oh, it's their purpose to make war on the land. And they will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. For he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings, and those with him are called, chosen, and faithful. Oh, friends, we're living in a time in which, when this has a fulfillment, the mystery of God is already at its unique position and posture. The great mystery that's been hidden from ages and generations is now called, chosen. Of course, they may have all been called and chosen from 1881, but never have they been in this category where they're faithful. Nor would we believe that the church that are with him are all faithful, because we believe that they're still probationary members, among of whom are some of us. And so when this final battle emerges, they will apparently try to attack the Lord's flank. You know, there are two wars spoken of here in Revelation. The one in Revelation 17, and by the way, this is one of the few chapters that's complete in itself. Revelation 17 starts out to tell you the judgment of the woman, and it completes with a woman judged. The other chapters are not that way. You have to correlate different chapters to get the whole story pieced together. But we believe there are not two wars spoken of. We believe that the war in Revelation 17 is very much the same war as in Revelation 19. There are not two such great wars. Rather, they show you the same war from two different standpoints, from two different vantage points, so that you can see the matter and its grand finale in all its infinite detail. All right, now, He says in the 15th verse, "And the waters that you saw, where the harlot is seated." Now notice he said to sit upon the heads and upon the waters. And there's a close relationship between this beast and the waters, because the beast is a people's form of government, but the government is dormant. It has not been able to function until it comes out of the abyss. Now, it says that this beast is of the seven. And we believe that it refers to a short period under the seven. Go back to Revelation 11. 11 verses 7 and 13. "And when they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends from the bottomless pit," or that is to ascend from the bottomless pit, "will make war upon them and conquer them and kill them." And then the 13th verse, "And at that hour there was a great earthquake, and a tenth part of the city fell." We believe that this was during the French Revolution. At this short period, the wild beast came out of the abyss, not all over Europe, but only in a tenth part of the city. Now, Brother Russell clearly believed that the French Revolution was a casting its shadow before it of what would take place at the end. That it was clearly what would take place at the very end, in Armageddon. And this wild beast that came out of the abyss was what? It was the middle class. They formed the commune. They formed the third estate. And it was they that were ruling France. And it was here that the heads began to roll. The kings of France, the royalty, and the church elements were the ones that were going to the guillotine. So dreadful and terrible was this time. It was the uprising of the people. Their voice in government turned out to be a dreadful time for the woman and the kings. And we believe that that was, of course, only in a tenth part of the city. But here at the end in Revelation 17 is when the beast comes out all over Europe. Completely emerges. And then will be the time for the destruction of the woman. So it's of the seven, that it's a likeness to one in this seven. Now it says, "The waters that you saw where the harlot is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns that you saw, they and the beast." Now, here is a critical point. You know, we said not to confuse the papal beast with the scarlet-colored beast. It's the ten horns and the scarlet-colored beast that destroy the woman. It's not the ten horns and the leopard-like beast that destroy the papal beast, that destroy the Roman Catholic Church. That would be an absurdity, wouldn't it? So it's the ten horns and the beast that destroy the woman. All right, now, are the words "and"? You know, there are some translations that say the ten horns upon the beast. Well, let me give you briefly. Von Tischendorf says, "The ten horns which thou sawest and the beast." Murdoch's translation of the Syriac, "and the ten horns which thou sawest, and the beast." Pergellus on Revelation says, "the ten horns which thou sawest, and the beast." The Greek Testament and notes by Wordsworth, he says this. In his comment on verse 16 and 17, he says, "Some of the cursive manuscripts and some of the early manuscripts of the Vulgate have epitotherion, that is, upon the beast. But Kai, that is "and," is found in the A, B, and the 12 cursive manuscripts cited by the scrivener, and the best manuscripts of the Vulgate, and in the Syriac version, and the Arabic, the Ethiopic, the Hippolyptic, and Irenaeus seems to have so read the passage. And this reading is received by Grisbach, Schultz, Bengel, Weiner, Blackman, Tischendorf, Pergellus. And then his concluding remark. He says, "And there seems little doubt that this is the true reading. In other words, there's little doubt that it's the ten horns and the beast. Not the ten horns upon the beast, but the ten horns and the beast together, which rules out it being the papacy. The papacy here would be represented in the woman, in a sense, because it's also a city, a government, which rules over the kingdoms of this world. So it's these ten kings who have received no kingdoms as yet. They will go together with a common form of people's government. And during this period, they will make war on the Lamb, and he will overcome them. And how does he overcome them? Why, he not only defeats them in their mission against him, but he puts it into their hearts to fulfill his will until the words of God are fulfilled. And that's what we're all concerned about, the judgment of the woman, the fulfillment of God's judgment against her. And that's what this story is all about. All this build-up has simply been to show you where and when and how and at what time the judgment against this woman would take place. And thank God we're living in a time in which it will shortly be done. She's still very much on the scene. We can't apply this into any period in the past, because when these ten kings and the woman, these ten kings and the beast turn on the woman, what do? Oh, they will make her desolate. Do you see her desolate now? Claims more following than any other pope in history. Now, think about that. Well, of course, she doesn't have as much of the world percentage of the world population, but she has millions upon millions. She's still influential. Ambassadors of state are still going there. Oh, when this judgment takes place, you won't have to wonder about whether it's really fulfilled or not. It will be fulfilled. Now, that's what he's talking about. And God puts it into their hearts to carry out his purpose. Well, what is his purpose? What was his purpose with Jezebel? It was to destroy her. The dogs would eat her flesh. That was his purpose with this woman. He hasn't fulfilled his purpose with regard to that woman yet. And they'll be of one mind and give over their royal power to the beast until the words of God be fulfilled. And they will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. Oh yes, this will bring us to the grand consummation. Now, and the woman which you saw. Now here is the part that shows that it's more than just the church. That woman that you saw is the great city, Babylon the Great, which is a government, which has dominion over the kings of the earth. And it has held that dominion over the kings of the earth. How long? Until the Lord puts it into their hearts to destroy her and to eat her flesh with fire. So be it.
Thank you, Brother Burns. We reconvene again at 11:45. That gives us 1/2 hour intermission. And Brother Rice will address us then. As we mentioned before, the teenage Bible class, that 13, 14, 15, and 16, will have a service 15 minutes earlier than our next one begins here. They will begin at 11:30 and go to 12:30. And Brother Stewart says, bring your Bibles to the young people. A two-door blue Skylark in the east parking lot has its lights on. Let us conclude our morning service with hymn number 311.
311. We'll rise in the last verse, and Brother Burns will dismiss us with prayer. The glory of the gospel. 311.
Our loving Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for the glorious truth that Thou hast given us. And we are so thankful that strong is the Lord that judgeth her. We are thankful that the end of the ages has come, that we are living in the period in which we shall see the triumphs of Thy judgment. And may we share Thy people's part. May we be faithful to the heavenly vision. And may not our hearts fail, nor our loyalty flag, but may we press on with vigor and with courage to represent Thee and Thy truth and the banner of Thy kingdom faithfully, joyfully, to the end. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.